Welcome to Optimal Health for Busy Entrepreneurs, the podcast for busy and high-performing entrepreneurs and leaders who are looking to create more energy and optimize their health while upgrading their brain and personal performance with precision. I am your host, Julian Hayes II. I've been involved with health and performance for over a decade. This podcast was created for the high performer who is unapologetically ambitious, the one who moves at a fast pace and operates with an edge, the one who wants to become superhuman. Nothing here is fluff, gimmicky, or feel good. I have little to no interest in simply helping you improve your life. I want to help transform it. By listening to this podcast, expect to have a body that feels just as good as it looks. Expect to possess a swagger and style that gives off an infectious vibe. Expect to command the stage or any boardroom you walk into with your executive presence. And lastly, expect to become your most enhanced self so you can live a limitless life. Now, let's get to the show. So welcome everyone. Oops. Oh, is a countdown to another episode of Optimal Health for Busy Entrepreneurs. I'm your host, Julian Hayes II, and I am back at it again with another fascinating individual. And I'm sure this is the first that many of you have not heard about in terms of what he does on a daily basis. So he is someone who fixes backs, but he also writes tracks. He's a physician. He's a musician. That kind of rhymes together, but he's a doctor by day, a musician by night. I am here with none other than James Robert Webb. How's it going, man?
I'm doing great, Julian. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you. You are the first of being a physician and a musician, and also the first country music physician on here. And, you know, so I'm surprised it took me this long. I'm from Nashville after all.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I'm the only one I know of. In the 80s, there's a Cleve Francis, a cardiothoracic surgeon who was a singer. Mm-hmm. I think he had a label deal in the 80s, and he's really good. He's still active, too. Remember, he's East Coast. I'm trying to remember. Philadelphia, maybe? But but he's this is very rare. I mean, it's because usually you follow your pathway to the people like us follow our pathway to, you know, the extreme of whatever and just focus on that last thing that we're doing.
Mm-hmm. And it's also, these are both time intensive activities. So I'm sure people are going to wonder, how are you actually keeping on top of both of these things that we'll get into? But before we stay in the present and even go to the future a little bit, let's go back in the future, back in the past, and learn about you, your origin story and everything, and how'd you get to where you are now?
Sweet. I sound like a superhero. I love it. origin story. Yeah, I grew up in a small rural, I actually grew up out in the country. I went to a small rural school outside of, you know, probably like 20 minutes outside of Tulsa, Oklahoma. So, my parents were, my mom was a school teacher. My dad was a construction worker, a sheet metal worker. And, my mom was the first person to go to college on either side of the family, you know, to be a teacher. And, then I think I might've been the second or whatever, but I was definitely the first person to get an advanced degree. And I think, you know, growing up in that town, it's a great town. There's good and bad things about everything. Right. I actually grew up out in the country on like a 10-acre farm and, you know, went to school in the big city of 800 people or whatever. And I always quote, what's the guy's song? Little Pink Houses, John Cougar Mellencamp. Mm-hmm. Small town. That's the song I'm thinking about. Small. I was born in a small town, you know, where there's little opportunity. I love that line because when me and my friends were going to school, I mean, I didn't realize I was going to be a doctor or any of this stuff. I didn't realize I was going to be a singer or songwriter. I mean, me and my friends were always, making parodies of songs and, you know, making up raps and stuff like that when we were kids. But, maybe those are little seeds of that kind of creativity. But we didn't really have, you know, in that town, the only people we knew that went to college were teachers, you know, and coaches. So there wasn't really a model for, like, you know, success as a medical professional or an attorney or, you know, things like that. You know, most of the people that live there, you know, it's kind of a bedroom community, and, you know, our parents, you know, worked in the bigger city or whatever. A lot of people work on a farm and stuff, even, you know, in this time. So, part of it for me was to just to be able to break out of that mindset, or to even to just be able to realize that, you know, I could do something else. And I was always really lucky to be academically successful, and school was kind of easy for me. I mean, looking back, if you want to say like the origin story, like on the superhero, I do think looking back, like it was always easy for me to get good grades because I would study, but I didn't have to, you know, spend hours and hours and hours studying to, you know, to kill it. And so I was always at the top of the class for the most part, you know, or in the top two or three. And it came easy for me. And it's not just because I'm a white dude or whatever. It's just, it's a natural talent thing for whatever reason. Because I see, now I see in my kids and other people, a lot of people don't have that. It's just a gift to be able to do, to just be able to absorb things like a sponge and remember them and recall them. And I remember, like, when I was a teenager, a lot of my friends were, you know, they were going, getting drunk on the weekend or whatever, or they wouldn't study and they didn't have good grades. And I thought it was just because they weren't applying themselves as much as me. But now I'm like, I feel like adult because, you know, I was really privileged on that side to be able to do that. But then I've made choices, you know, it also comes down to choices of what are you going to do with your life? So I learned pretty early that I liked helping people. One of my first jobs after I got my driver's license was working at a nursing home. And so basically being an orderly, I found out I liked helping people. So I kind of pursued that and I became a nurse aide and like did a lot of home health and stuff. Then I went to college. I was going to be a physical therapist. That was kind of what the big department of whatever the big government agency that's telling you, we need these jobs and stuff. It was really a huge demand for physical therapists. And that's what I was, you know, I saw that as my ticket out of the small town kind of thing. And then I get to college and then I'm like tutoring all the pre-med students in chemistry and stuff, you know. And so then I start thinking, well, you know, maybe I could do that, you know, but it's, you know, it does come down to wherever you come from. It's like, do you have you either have to have a model of something, or you have to, you know, the universe can guide you and you have to be open to seeing those revelation.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, we actually share a lot in common. I don't even think we talked about this. I initially wanted to be a physical therapist. That's what I started with. It was physical therapy. Then I eventually was like, I think I want to do more. Then it went to medical school. Mm-hmm. And this is probably where our paths stop. I left after my year. You stayed. But that's interesting. And also absorbing information. I'm the same way. Like just absorbing different things, synthesizing ideas, it's relatively easy to me. So yeah. I totally get that. And it wasn't until I got out in the world, especially in the New York area, that I realized, oh, everyone doesn't just have this.
Right. Even if you live in New York, you know, just because you live in New York doesn't mean that you're more intelligent than everybody else. You know, there's plenty of intelligent people in New York, but it's kind of, you know, it's unusual. It's kind of a burden as well. Mm-hmm. Because it's kind of like, if you want to go to, you know, the Bible story of the talents, you know, it's like, if you've got these things that you've been given and what are you going to do with them? And, you know, for me, the drive is always like, you know, when I look back on my life, I don't want to like look at wasted opportunities or, you know, look at something that that I could, you know, wonder what might have been kind of thing. But at the same time, you have to choose what you're going to do. You can't do everything extremely well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Regret is probably the worst feeling in the world, I think. It's a bad poison.
It's a great driver. And I think there's a quote by Jimmy Iovine that I love that, you know, fear is very powerful. And basically it's like, if you can figure out a way to wrangle that fear so that it's driving you from behind rather than stopping you, you know, in front of you, it's a very powerful kind of motivator. That's paraphrasing what he said. But yeah, I mean, that's a phrase I commonly think of hearing people say is, you know, you only regret the things that you didn't do. Now, of course, you know, we make mistakes that, you know, are tragic, and we definitely going to regret things that we did. But in general, in life, more often than not, you know, you regret those missed opportunities.
And absolutely.
That could be anything from not taking a, you know, not taking this chance to go into a, you know, a career camp or whatever, or not asking a girl out or whatever, you know, and not seeing, you know, not going to tell grandpa hello that last time or whatever.
Yeah. And to sidetrack a little bit, because before I forget, when I was doing a little researching and I went through your Twitter, I saw that you talked, you shared a post about the song Remains the Same, the Led Zeppelin documentary. And so I, as one of my, so my best friend is a huge Led Zeppelin fan. And so, and so I got onto Led Zeppelin because of him, because he, I pretty much got indoctrinated. It was just like, you listen to it so much, you're like, okay, this is actually really good.
And, exactly.
And so the song Remains the Same. That was the documentary, right? So the live performance in Madison Square Garden. So I remember, I think I fell in love with Led Zeppelin when I heard the song Remains the Same, and then it goes into the Rain song. And that transition was just so like magical for me. I was like, wow. And so, what's your favorite Zeppelin song?
You know, there's so many, but it has to be, you know, I don't know. I mean, the Rain song is up there, because here's when I was a kid, I was probably 13, 14 when my dad bought me a guitar, you know, a pawn shop guitar, and I'm sitting in my room on rainy days and listening to the radio, and where I, you know, the classic rock station was KMOD in Tulsa. Listening to that kind of stuff, and I kind of taught myself to play guitar, trying to emulate the acoustic stuff that Led Zeppelin did, you know, Jimmy Page. So like Tangerine, or like Ramble On, or Babe, I'm Gonna Leave You, or, you know, the Rain song. And so one of the interesting things is I kind of learned to play the Rain song in a standard tuning. But there's the actual guitar tuning in that is like, I haven't really seen it anywhere else. It's just an alternate tuning. It's very interesting. So I just refer to it as the Rain song tuning. And I've kind of rediscovered, I didn't really figure that out until maybe like 5 years ago. So when you're a kid trying to learn, you know, and you're just using your brain to kind of like solve it, you know, like randomly brute force, you know, undo the bank vault lock of something. You don't, you know, I didn't stop and think. I'm just trying to, well, he can do it. I mean, somebody, it's physically possible. Like what's the deal? You know, what, how does he do that note? You know, how is he, you know, you have to really like contort your fingers to play it in a standard tuning. And then it's never quite exactly the same, but I think that's one good thing is that I don't, you know, play things exactly the same now. But now I've, you know, as an aficionado of Zeppelin, I've went back and learned how to play that in the Rain song tuning. And so, yeah, it's just a really cool song. I don't know what it is about it.
I think now I forgot. I think, actually, I think 10 Years Gone is my favorite song. Maybe not the Rain song. 10 Years Gone. Yeah. I think that's my favorite song.
I like the first five albums the most. And then there's like certain thing, obviously everybody loves Kashmir. I like a lot of the stuff off Physical Graffiti, for example, like Fool in the Rain. Fool in the Rain is one of my favorite songs because, you know, it is a unique Zeppelin song with that different kind of feel, and they go into the samba and in the middle, you know, all that stuff. Dun, 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 dun. And it's heavy piano. You know, a lot of times John Paul Jones is playing like the Mellotron, and there's not a ton of piano in Zeppelin stuff. And that's a good example of having a big, you know, that piano riff and dun, 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 dun. And I was a piano player in high school too. So that's part of what probably jived with me. But, you know, if I had to pick, like, if I could only have one Zeppelin album, it'd probably be three. Led Zeppelin three. Because it's so acoustic driven, and it's kind of, you know, they wrote a lot of that in the English countryside. And so songs like Friends, just some weird, you know, they sound really weird. You know, you got Immigrant Song on there too, which everybody knows, you know.
Yeah.
So there's just so many Zeppelin songs, you know, when I love the way that Jimmy Page would adapt things, you know, because he was a really respected blues guitarist before all this stuff. And he was so freaking young at that time, you know, him and Clapton and Beck, I think, were in the Yard Dogs. And even that Madison Square Garden, they look like so young on that. It's kind of funny.
Yeah. So I read a review about you musically, and the quote was a modern day honky tonker that avoids all the bro country cliches and lets the party proceed. So I'm curious, what are country cliches?
Yeah, I think they say the bro country cliches. You know, I'm going to back up. So when I was in high school, like, I really got into a variety of music for a couple of reasons. I think the universe just had it out for me on that. And that's how I got into Zeppelin, is like on the radio, all the stuff my friends were listening to, it all sounded the same to me. So it's like, you go back in time to like the hair band stuff, and you can't even tell the band, you know, so Warrant and Winger and White Tiger and White Lion and Cinderella and Great Shark and, you know, all these things. And to me, there's standouts and stuff. I'm being maybe unnecessarily cruel, but to me, I just got tired of it because it all sounds the same. So I started listening to stuff from the year I was born, for example. So I got into Sabbath and America and all these different people. So fast forward to like the last 5 years in country music, I don't really enjoy listening to country radio for the most part. A lot of it just kind of sounds the same. And a lot of it's that broken, what they refer to as bro country. But what I would say is right now, the last 5 years in country especially, everything is in a bar or everything revolves around drinking. Mm-hmm. And that's fine. Drinking has always been a part of country music. Drinking is a part of life and everything. But it's just like there's not a song that doesn't mention, you know, alcohol. Even this love songs are like in bars. Mm-hmm. You know, when I was growing up, my mom would say, you know, find a girl in church, you know, kind of thing. But it's like, there's no other way to meet somebody unless you're in a bar. Like if you are in this country music universe, it's right now, it's just kind of weird. It's almost like bizarro to me. So I would say the country cliches, I have a thing where I would say like bro country Mad Libs. So give me a part of a truck, give me a alcoholic beverage, give me a body of water, give me a piece of a female anatomy that you can say on the radio, you know, just stuff like that. And it's basically, you know, hey girl, shake it on the tailgate, throw me a cold can down at the riverside. You know, it's just like a lot of the songs are not very imaginative. They may be well crafted, but for me, it just doesn't. Cause as a listener, you know, when I grew up, I wasn't really into country. You know, I like music just whether I like music or not. Mm-hmm. You know, to me, it's either good or bad music. So I'm not really I love a lot of country music, but I'm not a country purist. I mean, I think my favorite time in country was probably the 90s. Mm-hmm. And that's probably because they were taking like the old country instrumentation stuff and fusing it with like the old school rock and roll things. And it was very creative and things, you know, like you had different artists. And this is kind of like Garth Brooks and even Alan Jackson was doing very like, I don't know, I'm not going to say, I'm trying to think of the adjective, like very, very country, you know, like very rural, mm-hmm. very good old boy kind of country stuff, but it sounded new and fresh.
Okay. So that's interesting. Yeah. Cause I guess that's probably the genre of music that I'm least familiar with.
Yeah.
But now that I think about it in my head a little bit, those few categories are in typically every song, especially the modern ones.
A lot of the modern ones that get promoted on the radio by major labels, let's put it that mm-hmm. way. And that's kind of, you know, that's always been the problem of music, of commercial music in any mm-hmm. genre, is because the record labels traditionally have lost money on 19 artists and they make it back up with the 20th artist, you know. So you have all these one hit wonders and a lot of people that never had anything. And the record companies are in generally like losing money on it until they get a, you know, Madonna or a Rihanna or Garth Brooks or whatever. So the drive from a survival of the fittest thing from a business perspective is, you know, record companies have to, you know, make money and they have to put things out that sell. So when you have a song like Cruise by Florida Georgia Line or mm-hmm. Boys Around Here by Blake Shelton that are so huge, then suddenly everybody's trying to recreate that lightning in a bottle. You know, mm-hmm. The record companies are like, oh, give us something, you know, write something that sounds more like blah, 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 you know? So anytime, I mean, you can write towards things like that, but the best songs come from like just a creative space, I think, you know, when you let the muse speak and aren't trying to pigeonhole it into something.
So speaking of that, I'm curious, like what's like your creative process?
Gosh, you know, it's a little all over the board, but Right now, I mean, I was journaling this morning because I'm really frustrated with a lot of things right now. And, you know, we're all frustrated. If you were honest, you think about it, there's times when you're frustrated and whatever. So frustration or negative emotions tend to, you can harness that to drive change, right? So I have to look at what's not working in my life today, you know, and that might be something that's just a short, you know, maybe this is just a, you know, something that's just happening this week or whatever. But for me over the last couple of months, like I spent a lot of time in May on the road again, you know, for the first time, like we're in songwriter festivals in Florida and stuff like that. So I didn't have my typical, you know, morning scheduled write time because I usually try to write every morning, you know, lyrically. And then I try to get on a piano and get in the studio and like do something just free form creative. So I find that the best way to be spontaneous is to schedule it, obviously, ironically, let me put it that way. Mm-hmm. I call it kind of scheduled creativity. Like I had to block some time that I'm going to be in the studio and record something. Just not, for example, like tomorrow I might plan, okay, I'm going to be in the studio and I'm going to do something that's not outcome driven. I'm just going to try to play around with just different sounds and things I might not usually do, or not worry about writing something to radio, you know, because then you might come up with something that's completely different and it might be good for an artist you've never heard in a different genre, or it might be good for film and TV or something like that. Some of my best songs have probably come from scheduled writing appointments that I do weekly, you know, with certain people. And even though that might, sometimes people think, well, if I schedule it, it's not going to be creative, you know, because I've got to go when the muse strikes or whatever. But the more you dedicate yourself to the craft, then the more, you know, the muse knows to show up, you know.
Absolutely. And that reminds me of the book by Stephen Pressfield. I think it's called The War of Art. And
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That's a great book.
I listened to it a few days ago again. It's just to kind of get my mind right about that, that a lot of times creativity and just creating in general, it's a messy process. And it's not as, I think, like how society and TV kind of makes it, like you just have these magical moments. It's really, you just, because somebody asked me, how do you write so much? And I was like, well, I have a writing session typically in the mornings, and sometimes I have one scheduled in the afternoon. And sometimes it's good words, or sometimes it's just junk. But the point is that I just consistently keep showing up.
And that's the thing. That's an important thing. So, yeah, I am definitely plagiarizing him a lot because he's somebody I've been reading lately, and I love his take on the war of art. But you're right. Sometimes it's brilliant and sometimes it's junk. But the key is, if you're going to be a professional at anything, you have to go to work, right? Mm-hmm. You know, you have to dedicate yourself to the craft. And so if you want to be a professional songwriter, then, you know, I've always taken that very seriously. You know, I try not to cancel on people. I'm trying to write all the time because it really comes down to numbers. You know, the more songs, the more articles, the more books or whatever you write, the more likely one is going to be, you know, have that secret sauce and be lightning in a bottle. And also at the same time, the more you write, the more you learn what works and what doesn't. And you learn the craft of doing it. Just like if you're a carpenter and, you know, you got to learn to hammer nails first, right? And you got to, you've got all these things you got to do physically in construction jobs or any kind of thing that you do. Even if, you know, for fun, if you're going fishing, is what you're trying to do. You got to learn how to fix the string when it breaks and when it gets tangled up, and you got to learn how to, you know, there's all these things. The more you learn on some part, it becomes more automatic, which can take you out of the moment and make you a little less mindful about it. But it also makes it a little bit easier to get into. But you're right. I mean, you never know when that, sometimes you get in and there are magical moments like in TV and movies. And when that comes, you've got to ride that horse till till it dies. and then back up and go back. But yeah, I think it's really interesting, you know, because there's a misperception about creativity, I think, especially among people who are, you know, quote unquote, left brain driven or, professionals and type A personalities. We're kind of trained to, intuition's kind of trained out of us. And intuition's a huge part, I think, of not just, you know, creativity, but even that left brain, you know, professional as a doctor, intuition's a huge thing.
I'm curious, how has how do you adjust those two things?
It's crazy. I guess part of me thinks, what else would I be doing in my spare time? Mm-hmm. I'm a middling golfer at best. I throw my back out more than I, hit a great score. I could travel, whatever. I mean, but after, once you can travel everywhere, anywhere you want to go or whatever, it's just like, what are you going to do? So let me back up. I mean, I think another mental exercise I like to use is, I can't remember where I've heard this. I've heard it from a lot of different places, but if you woke up tomorrow and won the lottery and had $50 billion or, $1 trillion or something, more than you can imagine. So what are you going to do with your life? Are you going to go back to work? Are you at a job that you love so much that you're going to go back? Well, if I was doing anything else in medicine other than what I'm doing right now, I probably wouldn't. I've got a lot of friends who, they spend half their time dealing with red tape and regulations and family doctors and ask the, in the U.S., anytime we see a patient, even we saw them 2 weeks ago, we have to ask them, have you had your Pneumovax? Have you had your flu shot? I mean, these all these kind of things that the government is imposing in this bureaucracy that separate the patient-physician relationship. I mean, I just, could not stand that. That's why there's, that's one of the reasons that there's such burnout in healthcare. But in my field where I'm at, and I didn't get there overnight. It took a lot of years of honing and following my intuition and facing fear and making decisions to go where I was led and shaving off parts of my practice that weren't essential to what my calling has been. Mm-hmm. That's been a process. Through that, I've gone from basically being a radiologist who sits in a dark room and reads x-rays all day to someone who's actually probably 99% clinical practice based on helping people with back pain that other people haven't been able to figure out, or patients with osteoporosis. And I get to actually make a huge difference in patients. So that's really, it could be addictive on that side, I think. It's just so rewarding to be able to help people. But it's really fulfilling is what I would say more than anything. I've always heard people say, if you find a job that you love, you never work a day in your life. And it's taken me a while to get there. And there's certainly negative things about my job. I have a bunch of red tape. And because I'm so focused in what I do, I'm kind of a statistical outlier in a lot of things. So I'm always under more scrutiny from informatics kind of standpoint. But outside of that, I mean, at the end of the day, that all washes out and I get to actually help people as opposed to, say, 10 years ago. Same thing goes with music, kind of back to that. If you find a job you love, you don't work a day in your life. I mean, I love writing songs and, my greatest hope is that, I can write music that inspires other people and changes their life the way that music's changed mine. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And speaking of that, I don't, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think I read 5 singles in the top 40. And is that still current?
I think on this album that we just released last May, mm-hmm. we're approaching, I think, 1.7 million streams mm-hmm. today. We've had all 5 radio singles have been top 25 at the Music Row, which is kind of the mm-hmm. secondary station country chart. This is the third consecutive top 40 on Billboard, Oak Husky Whiskey. and sent it like over 8,000 Shazams, I think now. Mm-hmm. Like this Oak Fusky Whiskey song has like somewhere like 1,600 Shazams or something, which is, you know, just past my second previous one by a couple of hundred. It's getting close to like 200 times a week. People are taking their phones out, hear the song, take their phones out, hit the Shazam app to hear what it is, to figure out, which, I mean, I think that blows my mind, you know, because I'm compared to everybody else I know, I use Shazam 10 times more than everybody else, but I maybe use it like two or three times a week. Mm-hmm. It's almost always when I'm listening to a, you know, movie or something or whatever. So to think that somebody's hearing music on the radio or wherever, and they're like, you know, clicking on the Shazam, I think that's cool. I mean, yeah, would I love for that to be 10,000 a week? Sure. You know, I mean, mm-hmm. yeah, we'll get there hopefully. But
yeah,
even if not, I mean, just, you know, one person, you know, anytime somebody, just to think, you know, from going back, you know, before 10 years ago when I wasn't even thinking about doing music to now, to if you told me 10 years ago that people were going to be hearing my stuff on the radio and one, you know, and liking it. And because I didn't like my voice when I was growing up, you know,
I mean, I'm the same way.
Blows me away. Well, I think it's like, I think you touched on this earlier on something on the writing part, when you're in college, I'm trying to remember, but basically, you know, I never had any vocal training. I was a musician from an early age, you know, mm-hmm. my earliest memories are, you know, playing around on the piano when I was probably like four or whatever, you know, making noise. You know, listen to music at my parents' console, you know, on the headphones back then before they were cool. But I never sang, you know, I would record myself on cassette or whatever. And like what I heard didn't match what I thought, you know? And so, but the translation is looking back now as a seasoned music industry, professional is that I didn't have any vocal training. So my voice didn't have training. So I wasn't holding pitch. But I have a good ear for pitch being a musician. So I could hear that, but I couldn't quite translate that was the issue. And plus I hadn't found my own voice because I was emulating like singing karaoke or maybe impersonating is another way. You know, like I would be impersonating the singer. And then also there's an aspect of range, you know, for me, because I had definitely have a baritone, more baritone voice. And so if I'm comparing myself to like, you know, somebody with a really high voice, a guy with a really high voice, is not going to work. You know, some people, you know, like, I don't know. I mean, I feel kind of silly looking back now, but I think probably there's other people than me that think, well, if you're a singer, you can sing anything. You know, like if you're a natural born singer, you should be able to sing everything. You should be able to sing like, you know, like, and it's just not reasonable to have like an 8-octave range, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's why, I mean, you have opera singers.
Right.
And you have people that sing the blues. Just like right. For myself, I'm not going to really write like poetry.
Yeah.
But I can write advice. I can write articles about giving advice and making yourself better. Just those typical business columns and health columns. But I'm not going to go write poetry. I'm probably not going to go write. I think we all have different lanes that we exist in.
Yeah.
So I think that comes from people who probably don't understand it as much. And they just see that, oh, you're playing an instrument. You should be able to play any song. They have guitars, but you're like, well, like you mentioned with the Led Zeppelin,
yeah.
There's a lot more nuance that the average eye is not going to catch. Cause I sure didn't catch it. I just thought it sounded good. I didn't know all the extra stuff that was going on.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I didn't, you know, you don't know about alternate tunings. If you're self-taught by a guitar, you know, unless you get with somebody else or read something, you know, you're not going to know about alternate tunings and that kind of stuff. So, yeah, I mean, it's, yeah, people have their wheelhouse. You have things that resonate with you. I mean, I think that's my biggest advice to people is, you know, if something resonates with you, you know, God put that in your heart. You know, there's a reason for that there. You're made that way, whatever, you know, whatever this, you know, you can say God, the universe, it doesn't matter to me, but it's just like, for whatever reason, if you have a desire in your heart, there's a reason for that and you should follow it. And it doesn't always mean that, you know, does that mean you're going to go drop everything and go to Nashville and be a singer-songwriter or whatever? You know, if you've got a stable career, no.
Yeah.
But is there, you know, somewhere in between there? You know, can you still contribute? Can you develop that aspect of your life? But, you know, I think when you go back, when you were asking about, you know, balance and stuff, you know, for me, I've got three little, I say little, but I mean, I've got three kids that live mm-hmm. at home, and, you know, from 10 to 16, and and I'm married, and I've been married for 25 years, so I want to keep that together. I mean, that's another part of the life you have to balance. So for me, I've always kind of, I try to, you know, my left brain tries to like put these rules or process. So like, as bad as it sounds, because this is opposite of what I was taught, I have to come first. I mean, you can say my spirituality, but you know, overall my, you know, if James doesn't show up for work, if James can't work, if James has a breakdown or whatever, you know, if James isn't healthy and is in the hospital or whatever, then everything else around me comes crashing down. Right. So you have to really focus on maintaining your own health. And that's not just physical health, but also, you know, mental health, spiritual health. You know, you have to, you know, have whatever, however you deal with things metaphysically, you know, I'm kind of into mysticism. It's how, what works for me. So, cause I, you know, I think there's a lot out there that we don't understand, but, humans try to put labels on them. And, you know, almost every great religion or philosophy recognizes that humans are fallible. You know, you know, humans disagree. And so I think anytime you get into dogma, that's kind of a little bit of a problem. So I grew up in kind of a dogmatic denomination. So I've had to kind of work through that and realize, well, it's okay to not, you know, not to not say everything is black and white.
Yeah. But, I feel like we're twins.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm the same here.
I'm with you. Well, there's a lot of commonality, I think.
Yeah. And I think it also maybe, you think it's the region also, just because, you know, because I'm from Tennessee and you're like a neighbor pretty much.
Yeah. I mean, exactly. We're pretty close. I mean, we're driving maybe like 8 hours away, but we're in the same time zone. We're basically the same latitude, you know. Well, you know, it's all kind of, yeah, I mean, it's very similar. And, you know, I think growing up in America, too, we grew up in a time, you know, like parents in the 50s, they came up in a very structured post-World War II time where you had what we consider, you know, very traditional family structures and things, you know, and which is nothing wrong with that. There's actually a lot to be said for that, you know, to have not that you can't have, you know, not that you have to have this nuclear family with a mom and dad and 2.3 kids or whatever. But I mean, there's obviously other kinds of families that work out there. But as we've done that for whatever reason, I think, you know, in the last 30 years, especially, we've seen society kind of change, kind of move the goals a little bit on everything, you know, and society is going to do that. But I think the big rapid catalyst is the internet, right? You know, so ideas spreading faster than, you know, whereas something before might take 20 years to take hold, you know? So I think there's a lot of that. There's society, you know, there is a more dependence on religion, and religion's something that's necessary, especially if you go back. Here's the problem, I think, with intellectuals. Okay. So intellectuals have their blinders on just like everybody else. Okay. It takes, you really have to think to not be so not egotistical, but egocentric on things. This is probably a little bit deeper than most podcast kind of talks, but I always tell people intelligence is a bell curve, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, if 100 IQ is average, you know, you've got, for everybody that's 130, you've got somebody at 70, and which is, you know, basically borderline mental retarded. And so there's different abilities, different capability of people to understand concepts, you know, more complex concepts require more intelligence. Okay. But then a lot of times the intelligentsia over here with the higher IQs thinks, well, why doesn't everybody get this? You know? So we need things, you know, in society, you know, we've got what, over 350 million, do we? That's India. I'm trying to think how many people we have in the U.S. now. You know,
it seems like we're Google check. Let's see.
Like 30. I can't remember
what we got. Let's see what we got. We have, it looks like basically 331 million.
Is 331. They're going to be talking about a COVID baby boom here pretty soon too. You know, I got to think, right.
What else are you going to do?
Yeah, exactly. What else are you going to do? I mean, we've got all these people, right? And to some extent in the society, you have to control people. Okay. I don't want to say like, you know, we must control and, you know, conspiracy theory things, but you can't, you know, have people running around and destroying everything. I mean, you can, but I mean, you know, we haven't become the greatest country, you know, in the world, that way. I mean, there's certain things that for a functioning society. You know, what society has to decide what kind of function it wants. And there are things like, you know, religion's necessary. I mean, if I think a lot of people for me, I grew up in a denomination where every word in the Bible is literally true and there's no contradiction in the Bible. Okay. So, and I've heard preachers in that denomination pick apart every other denomination, right? So I always used to say, well, they can show you how every other denomination's wrong, and then all you have to do is show two verses that don't match it, you know, don't match, and then that kind of comes crumbling down. You know, I have evolved to a view that, you know, most reading other sacred texts that, you know, pretty much most religion in the world have similar origin stories. You know, there's flood stories, mm-hmm. there's these, you know, creation stories and things. And I think what people forget is that, you know, and people that maybe can't grasp as many abstract concepts don't understand is that all these documents started out as oral traditions, right? These are stories that are passed down around the campfire, you know, as we're starting to, you know, start to have society, you know, hunter gatherer and things like that. So, you know, then later on, then we started ascribing this stuff to it, like, well, this is all true, and if you don't, we're going to kill you and we'll burn you at the stake and all this stuff. So, you know, anything taken to the extreme is a problem, right? But you have to find, at the same time, you can't just throw out the baby with the bathwater. You know, like if you try to, on one side, it is kind of like coming out of a cult to come out of that thought process that, you know, every word in the Bible is literally true and you can't question anybody in authority and yada, yada, yada. Once you work it out of that, it's hard. You almost have to from that perspective, you want to use Einstein, you have to basically, from that perspective, you have to become agnostic towards that worldview. And then you basically have to become atheist to that worldview to try to see what the truth is. And, you know, I've always been a big believer that, you know, if you believe in God, that God isn't going to lead you astray. You know, he's going to lead you to follow that way, if you want to think of it that way. And for me, I think I keep coming back to that thought process. Well, Jesus came down and was fighting with the Pharisees, right? He came down to challenge the religious leaders at the time, if, you know, if we're using that worldview. To me, this is a very controversial statement, especially if it was in my church I grew up in. But, you know, when I read the words of Jesus, like in the red letter edition, Jesus really sounds like a Buddhist to me. Not a Hindu, but he sounds like, you know, a Buddhist, very Eastern kind of philosophy. And I think, you know, he was probably at the crossroads in trade where, you know, all those ideas were coming. But that's a revolutionary thought process, right? And even for a kid like me from a small town to, you know, to come up and kind of come through that, it takes a lot of energy and a lot of thought and time when you're doing that yourself too, right? I think a lot of people that come out of that, then they get stuck in the atheism thing, right? They mm-hmm. think, well, there's no God. But to me, I mean, it's really clear that there's something greater than all of us. And I see that every day when I'm writing, that, you know, these ideas come from somewhere else.
Yeah, I really get that. I actually have a handful of Buddhist books on my shelf, mm-hmm. just out of curiosity. And right. And I think that with the creative process as well, and even, you know, there's even creativity when you're working with patients. It's not just with your music. It's even working with patients. Like sometimes there's these intuitions, there's these insights that come that you see things. You kind of see things like five moves ahead.
Yeah.
And it's hard to, you can't just really explain that. So it's some type of thing going on that you can't explain, and you can't even explain it to others. And if you try to, and they don't get it, or they're not even remotely in that world, then they're not going to get it. And the reason why I say that is because, you know, there's a lot of people who, you know, a lot of people on this podcast are, they have some entrepreneurial endeavor, venture that they're trying to go after, or they're trying to pursue something that's maybe out the ordinary. And like you mentioned, coming from your town, stepping out from those beliefs, that can be lonely at times.
Absolutely.
You know, that can be lonely at times and take a toll on your mental and emotional health, because you're almost like, am I the crazy one or are they the crazy one?
Right. It's like being in the Matrix, you know?
Yeah, exactly. That's a very good point. That's a very good point.
Yeah. Or being Harry Potter, you know, and wondering why did my cousin fall into the.
Yeah. So over the last year, you haven't been able to tour that much, at least. So how have you built this? How have you kind of continued to build momentum still?
Well, I mean, that's a good question. Let's come back to that real quick, because I want to touch on something you just said, because you're stepping outside of that and wondering, are you the crazy one? Because I'd say not everybody has everybody doesn't have the intellectual capacity to do that, right? Mm-hmm. Number one. And then of those people that do, only a small part of them have the courage to face it. And then a lot of the problem, like you said, you feel lonely and all this stuff. It's, so much of this is done subconsciously, like you're thinking things, but you don't ever say it out loud. You know, once you say something out loud, it makes it, it's kind of like the test for craziness is what I say. Because the universal sign for crazy is this. And I think that goes back to the circle and the amygdala and all our, you know, like in our neurological mm-hmm. process of memory and things. You have to say it out loud. You know, there was something else that I heard that, like, if you're stuck on a desert island after so many years, you like learn, you forget to how to talk because you stop talking out loud, you know? So maybe that whole thing with Tom Hanks talking to the Wilson soccer ball is maybe what keeps your sanity. So, it takes the capacity to do it. You know, it takes being called to make a change, you know, to step outside of that. It takes bravery to follow that call. And then that's just the beginning of the hero's journey on transformation on that. Right. Then it's kind of like, you're almost like a shaman. You know, if you want to go way back in time, like you're the person that's kind of been called to not do everything else, like to try to see what else is there. And when you talk about intuition for patients, I mean, that's kind of part of my journey of like learning, well, I'm called to do this. You know, nobody else does this. Like, there's a procedure called kyphoplasty that we fix vertebral fractures with. Okay. Everybody, most people that I were trained with that I know that do it, they do it kind of as a technician, like a doctor says, well, this person's got a fracture, fix this. So the person that does it is kind of like a technical person. They do it and they send them back. Right. But what I learned early in my fellowship is that, there's a way that these should be managed that most people agree on. I mean, big societies agree that if somebody has a fracture and they'll have osteoporosis, and if they have osteoporosis, they need to be treated XYZ. They need to be on medication. They need to do all these things. But the problem is, in practical standpoint, that never happens. I mean, like 90% of the time, I would say maybe that, you know, it gets overlooked. I mean, that's basically my practice is basically built on filling in the gaps of these people that have fallen through the cracks because they didn't. When I noticed when I was in fellowship, I would do a kyphoplasty. Patient might come back in 6 months or 3 months with another fracture. I'm like, oh, I'm sorry this happened again. You know, what did your doctor put you on? Well, they didn't put me on anything. They told me I didn't have osteoporosis, but which is incorrect. You know, that's the problem. Like when you have defined, you know, we have defined diagnosis and treatment things, and then they're not being followed. That's mm-hmm. kind of the problem there. So as I saw that need, that's where I went more and more towards that direction and more also shed the robes and accoutrements of being just a radiologist that's a diagnostician only and not a treating, healing person. So that all, part of that goes subconsciously, and then you have to kind of like figure it out and make those changes. If you're going to be a revolutionary in your field, you can't do, if you want to do something that no one's ever done before, you can't do it like everybody else has done. So you have to look at, I always say, take people that think outside the box. Those are good people to study, but then they don't realize that they're in a box. So you have to think outside, you know, they're in a box. You need to realize that, be the person that thinks outside the box that they're in that they don't know, kind of thing. You know, so you have to think, I'm thinking outside the box, but what am I not anticipating? What am I not thinking? Mm-hmm. And I think stylizing things, simplifying them, and kind of taking, always questioning things that we accept as axiomatic. That's where the revolutionary discoveries happen, right? Mm-hmm. You know, if we say you can't do this because it's always, you know, X, Y, Z, well, then that might be the clue that the universe is giving you that you need to really look into that. So for example, right now we're working on a study. So for these fractures in spine, there's like close to 1 million of these fractures in the U.S. a year. A bunch of them are treated. We found a lot of things like in the literature, looking at all the Medicare database, the patients that get these fractures, 85% of them die within 10 years if they get this procedure compared to not getting it. Their life expectancy, their survival rate more than doubles, like to 38%, something like that. And yet people are like still in denial about it. And more importantly, one of the determinants of if somebody gets this procedure is a certain finding on MRI, if it lights up or not. And it works because when it's present, it seems like it's almost always correct, which means in medical terminology that that test has a very high specificity. So when it's positive, it's likely to be an indicator of that disease. Because if you're wanting to know if somebody has a fracture, it needs to be treated. If that test is positive, then it's probably 95% or more likely that that's accurate, right? Mm-hmm. Which also gives us another medical terminology, a positive predictive value, which means that when it's positive, that means the likelihood of it actually being true is very high, okay? But the problem is we've looked at the accuracy of this test in different parts of the body, like the knee and orthopedic things outside the spine. But there's over 3,000 English language articles on this procedure in the medical literature. And I started by wondering, you know, like, because what I'm seeing in patients doesn't match what people, the practice, you know. What I was taught is you examine the patient. That's how you tell if they have a fracture, right? The physical exam, that's what you do in a trauma setting, you know, somebody's in a car wreck, you get them out, or a level one trauma center. That's how I was trained to do it. And a lot of times the MRI doesn't light up. And the more and more I saw that, the more I thought, well, you know, that's not a really good test. So we started looking at the literature, and there's really, we could not find a single study looking at the accuracy of MRI in the thoracic and lumbar spine, where most of these procedures are done. There was only one study that looked at in the neck at the very top, like a hangman's fracture. And that only picked up 54%. So it's no better than a coin flip on the spine. So now we're doing a study of actually, you know, looking at what is the accuracy here. You know, it's really good when it's positive, but what's our negative predictive value? If it's not present, meaning what's the sensitivity? How many, if you've got a fracture, how many people does it pick up? And if it only picks up 1 out of 2, it's a crappy test and it needs to be abandoned. But no one's done this because the opposite works so well. Mm-hmm. But the problem is all these patients have that are just told that nothing's wrong with them, right? And then those patients go on and 85% of them die in 10 years because, you know, nothing's being done. So it's taken me like 15, 20 years in practice to kind of stew all this stuff subconsciously and have the bravery to kind of like start confronting people about it, because mm-hmm. there's absolutely no evidence, scientific evidence, for the way most people treat. So that's, you know, if you keep focus on your calling, you're eventually mm-hmm. going to find, I found the more you focus on something like that, the more likely you are to, you know, to be able to make a difference. Mm-hmm. And this is a huge, you know, kind of like, I consider it like a JAMA level article, because, it's such a basic thing that nobody has ever really looked at. It's a travesty.
Yeah. You know, listening to that, you know, what I see is like, and I see, you know, you could take what you're talking about right there and apply it to any discipline.
Right.
It's like you learn the basics, you learn the fundamentals to get very good at your craft specifically. And then right. you step out and you start improvising. I think of like a, I don't know, like a John Coltrane, like a, let's use music. John Coltrane. I know he studied a lot of classical music, to my knowledge, mm-hmm. that he then brought into his jazz. And that's part of the reason why it sounded so different.
Yeah.
And it's also the book Mastery is a very good book for listeners out there who are Mastery by Robert Greene. And he talks about a lot of people who in various disciplines who are doing this exact thing that you're just doing right there, where there's a certain way of doing things, and you just kind of disregard the times it doesn't work for people. And then you start to question, like, why are we just disregarding
right.
this glaring hole here?
Right. Right.
You know, why are we questioning in status quo? So I think that's a very key thing that you brought up there, and that listeners can really take and really apply right now, especially because you see a certain way that somebody goes about their business. You see, and health and fitness is a big thing as well with that, that a lot of times we give blanket statements on this types of diets is supposed to work right. with you. this type of exercising regimen is going to work with you. And I, you know, we're like 99.9% the same, but that 0.1% is huge. And right. So that leads me to, how did you get involved? Let's talk about your health and fitness. And you've talked about it a little bit. I saw in some of your posts, and keto has been working good for you. Is that correct? Is it still good? Working
good for me when I'm on keto, you know?
Okay.
I think, you know, to the point of what you're just talking about, we make these blanket recommendations that it doesn't work for everybody. I think there's a big public health crisis that people haven't recognized in the last 40 years. On one side, cardiologists have went in and just revolutionized cardiovascular health. Before, if you had a heart attack, right, you're smoking, you know, whatever, you know, you're eating whatever, and then you have a heart attack, the cardiothoracic surgeon does a bypass and they treat you and treat you, right? And what did the cardiologists do? The cardiologists came along and they developed, you know, angioplasty. Radiologists actually did that, interventional radiologists, but it's because those radiologists wouldn't see patients, you know, they're afraid of patients, but not as a general, you know, as a specialty. Mm-hmm. Cardiologists kind of took that over, right? So, but cardiology in general, that field, you know, angioplasty, stents, less invasive, less expensive, more effective methods of treatment for people once people come in with a heart attack. You know, some people still need a bypass. You're always going to have people that need a four-vessel CABG, right? But there's a lot of people that you can avoid that more severe, more invasive, higher mortality rate intervention by doing these less invasive things, right? What else did cardiologists do? Well, they did the literature. They did the research. You know, why are people, you know, what is different between patient A and patient B that have a similar diet? You know, there's probably genetic susceptibility. You know, what are causes of this stuff? Smoking, high blood pressure, finding out high cholesterol is a factor, you know, and then how do you treat those? You know, smoking cessation, cardio workout, you know, for a lot of people helps that. That's, you know, a mainstay and stuff like that. And then for people that have a high cholesterol, low fat diet, right? Okay. Those are all good things. Okay. Those are all contributions positive to society and medical knowledge, but here's a problem. With all those good things, there's a negative thing here, talking about the cholesterol. So the cholesterol is like, there's two examples I'd say in cardiovascular health. One is this blanket recommendation for a low-fat diet and blanket recommendation for low-salt diet, okay? And the problem is the low-salt diet is really targeted to people. They tend to be more patients in certain genetics that are that hang on to salt more, and so that can contribute to hypertension, that can contribute to volume overload and be strainful in the heart. But most people don't have that, you know. And I think that's I forget where that is. That's Mediterranean tend to have that or don't have it. I'm blanking right now because it's not my specialty. But the problem is now everybody's like on a low salt diet. Well, that might not be good for everybody, right? You know, absolutely. It might take us decades to kind of see that. And I think what now we're really seeing a public health emergency that I don't think people are really connecting. Okay. But the whole low fat recommendation is not also necessary for everybody. You know, does it help in general? Do Americans tend to eat probably too much fat in general, you know, 50 years ago or whatever? Probably, maybe. But those are also genetically susceptible individuals. If people have high cholesterol, a lot of that tends to be genetic based, not just mm-hmm. diet. It's not majority diet from what I understand, right? That's a portion of it. So like for me, when I was 360 pounds at my peak, my cholesterol was still like better than most people, you know, like I, you mm-hmm. know, for whatever reason, I have great genes. It's better to pick your parents better. Right. So we forget that people are different. You know, right now, part of our problem in society and culture are we take identity politics. And if I'm a white middle-aged guy in Oklahoma, all of us are exactly the same. We think alike, we have mm-hmm. the same genetics, everything else, right? You know, and if you're a Pacific Islander that lives in Oregon, you know, everybody's the same, right? And nobody's an individual. They all vote for one party or whatever. But in reality, you know, people are, each person's unique, right? Our genetic makeup's different. And we're just starting to get into the dawn of the age of genetically kind of mm-hmm. based diagnosis and treatment. But I think that's a big thing that we see right now. Getting back to the public health emergency, is the blanket low-fat diet recommendation has resulted in a much higher carb consumption in the U.S. Okay. And so what's the other big killer? Diabetes, right? So diabetes is also probably a genetically susceptible disease. And so when you have low fat yogurt or low fat, whatever, the manufacturers make it for the taste by adding sugar, right? So you have high sugar and you don't have fat, and fat is a necessary nutrient, right? Absolutely. People think in their head that you can't have fat, and people think that cholesterol is bad. Cholesterol, everybody has cholesterol, and all, if you didn't have cholesterol, you wouldn't be alive. Cholesterol is a necessary component in cell walls and all these other things, to make hormones and things like that. It's just too much of, certain things. So I really think that our blanket low-fat recommendation to everybody has resulted in a lot, has been a major contributor in the crisis for diabetes that we're seeing right now. And I know keto does not work for everybody. Keto can be terrible for somebody who has genetic high cholesterol problems, because that can make it even worse. But for somebody like me, for whatever, and I think diabetes tends to run in my family, it seems to be the magic bullet for me. My problem is just staying on it, because I have a 16-year-old who loves to bake. And so I'm always okay.
that's the only thing with that. I would recommend it more, but I just found that so many people, it becomes harder to stick with it. But I think sometimes they could cycle. I think so, as kind of a happy medium point, I think cycling in and out has seemed to be more ideal for people.
Yeah. And for me, you don't have to be in ketosis for me, it's my problem is, I've been hugely overweight before. So my body's always going to want to try to thermostat, save more fat. Right. And for me, it's an overeating thing. I mean, that's the compulsive overeating issue, or mindless eating, whatever. Those are the big issues for me that I have to deal with. And people have to be honest about what your psychopathology is, And somebody that's hard to figure out on your own. I mean, get some help with somebody else. Yeah. Keto worked for me, but I was always very lucky that I never got the keto flu. And a lot of people get that, I got the keto flu once, and I think it's because I hadn't been doing any kind of restriction before. I started to feel for people, because the first time I went on keto, it was easy for me because I'd been doing intermittent fasting just kind of naturally. Cause I just usually, I've kind of learned, I'd read a lot of the things like the starvation study they did back in the 40s, the Minnesota thing, and some of these myths in diet, they work for a lot of people, but obviously it doesn't work for me. So for me, breakfast is not the most important meal of the day. if I have breakfast and I have anything that has carbs in it, I'm going to be snacky all day. It's just like if I had spaghetti or something with carbs at lunch, I'm going to be like bloated, and maybe that's from gluten, and I'm just gonna get tired and kind of drain. And that's for me, and that's not for everybody, but that's certainly something I identify with. So carb restriction for me has always kind of worked more. It's just keto is kind of more of it's almost like Atkins, but a little less restrictive, because you can have some carbs on keto. And for me, you don't really have to be in ketosis so much. For me, since so much of my problem is compulsive overeating or mindless eating, both of those things, like trying to snack at night or whatever, just staying on like a low carb diet, even if I'm eating more, then it's usually less of a problem, because it's not driving the cycle of high sugar spikes and then dropping low and wanting to have some more sugar kind of thing.
Yeah. And that's a prime example, even with appetite. That's different. That can be genetic as well, because we have appetite hormones. So those are going to be at different levels for each of us. And usually, typically, the people who are carrying a little more weight are going to have more misaligned hunger signals as well. So that makes it more difficult. So for me, I actually, breakfast is the most important meal for me right now, because I have to feed like an engine. It's like a furnace.
You're training, right?
Yeah, because of my training style now. And also, if you mentioned that you stress eat a lot, so times that I'm really stressful, I don't eat. I don't eat. So I don't eat. And each side has its negatives either. So that can be just as detrimental as stress eating, just for different reasons. And so it's very interesting how the human body is, and there's a lot that we're still learning about.
And the mind-body connection. I mean, you hit on that, the whole the cycle thing. It's really kind of about a binge and purge thing. And you don't have to be a full-on bulimic or anorexic to have that. To some extent, binge and purge is a very healthy thing in some aspects. Like, if I know I ate too much at Thanksgiving dinner, so I probably don't need to eat tonight. You know, I'm not hungry.
Yeah.
I mean, I need to purge a little bit like that, but when it becomes a compulsive behavior, that's the problem. And so that's when people with eating disorders tend to not, they tend to keep that inside in the subconscious, right? And so then it's like the crazy thing there. So talking to other people about it, getting in support groups, mm-hmm. Whatever, you know, that could be Overeaters Anonymous. That could just be talking to a counselor. That could be talking to somebody else or sharing experience online with people. I found the more you connect with other people on anything that's an intellectual frontier, the better. So that if we're talking about trying to find breakthroughs in your field, you want to talk to other people that are in that mindset. And if you're struggling with compulsive overeating, then you want to talk to other people with that problem or people that have overcome it kind of thing and share that, share the experience.
Absolutely. And I can go on another hour talking about this,
right.
And yeah. I want to be mindful of your time. So as we wrap this down, I'm curious to know what's the future hold for you in terms of your music. So is it another album that's going to come soon? Where are you?
Yeah, I'm trying to, everything's kind of been shut down. You know, my country producer, Buddy Cannon, who's, you know, amazing, mm-hmm. has rightfully been a little under the radar, you know, trying to avoid too much exposure because we got a lot of family that are susceptible, right? Mm-hmm. And so we haven't really been in studio much. I've done some studio things. At the same time, I still have some songs on this last album that we may put some more singles out on the radio for this. But then I have to also look at digital, you know, like online, you know, everybody said, you know, you have to kind of constantly keep releasing new music, to kind of keep people's interest. And that's kind of true, but more I've tried to do that this year by, going in different genres and, releasing music that's maybe a little bit not what people might expect from me. So like I've released a couple of, piano vocal things, like one's a cover of that Nirvana Heart-Shaped Box song most recently. One was a piano vocal song of me that I wrote called Horse Named Freedom that's out there. So that's almost maybe a movie soundtrack or something, or like a Yellowstone or a Longmire kind of thing. Mm-hmm. I've also done some throwback things like the On the Other Hand by Randy Travis. And I haven't really released any like the rock or pop stuff that I'm doing, and I'm trying to wait for that time. But I'm still kind of working on that. I'm trying to find another producer in that field kind of to try to, you know, focus that creativity a little differently. So I think in what we're looking at soon as far as releases, as I am working towards a country project, there's probably a little bit more high energy rock kind of mm-hmm. influenced, maybe like Hank Williams Jr. or maybe Brooks and Dunn, or I don't know, like Motley Crue or Billy Idol or something. I don't know, just something that's more a little bit more energetic mm-hmm. that I like. I also am really looking at doing a Western swing project where it's just kind of almost just a tribute to kind of like that old Western swing sound, mm-hmm. but kind of a modern update for it, because Buddy, Ken, and I both love Western swing. And, you know, as we get out there, I'm really looking forward to, you know, playing in new places and collaborating with new people and continuing to write with a variety of people and just seeing what we can come up with. So I don't know what the future holds, but I do know that I'll continue, following this creativity. I hope to continue to get more cuts with other artists and eventually, you know, be a big hit songwriter and that kind of stuff. Not so much for the glory or fame, but just to know that I'm at the apex of what I'm setting out to do, you know, just mm-hmm. for achievement.
That's awesome to hear. And I look forward to keeping up with you and everything. And so where can listeners learn more about you and keep up with you at?
Yeah. I try to keep things simple. So my website's jamesrobertwebb.com. On any of the socials, it's all exactly James Robert Webb. So YouTube, TikTok, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, whatever. I'm probably least active on Twitter. I don't know. Twitter's just a little different animal. TikTok's a different animal. I mean, if you want to see me being goofy or just weird stuff with me, TikTok's probably the best thing. I mean, I've had where I've had if you want to see me, you know, as the artist, mostly is, you know, probably Instagram, you know, and Facebook. But TikTok's kind of my biggest success there has just been being, you know, I don't know, parroting, seeing my goofy side, right? You know, like my biggest, like I have a video that has like 850,000 views where I'm just duetting somebody, you know, just kind of making fun of it. But awesome. And then my music ones have like 200 views or whatever.
So I will have all those links in the show notes and everything. And man, this has been an awesome conversation. It's been wide ranging. It's definitely been one of my more interesting conversations. So, and I hope listeners think that as well. So we've been all over the place, and but I think there's some key lessons that you can put together in this conversation. So without further ado, listeners, stay awesome out there, be limitless, and of course, go be superhuman. Peace.
Between Deep Fork and the Buckeye Creek, amongst the briar thickets and the blackjack trees, Papa lived there in a rusty tin roof shack with a blacksmith's forge that poured out clouds of smoke out back. And when the markets crashed and the hard times came, the law looked the other way. Town in between, he was hauling 100 proof out underneath the stars, long before the interstates and Earnhardt, shipping shine in that Pontiac with the jugs sloshing in back. Oh. Found my granddad still, but I got into blacksmith and fired up that forge. And there's a brick on a stump about 100 yards south of the porch. So when midnight comes, leave a 20 and a 5. When you come back, you'll find.